From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Icelandic film director Baltasar Kormákur about his new film, 101 Reykjavik. It's a comedy about a 28-year-old slacker, his mother, and the female flamenco dancer they both fall in love with. It won the Discovery Award for the Best First Film at the 2000 Toronto Film Festival. Baseball pitcher David Cone is a Cy Young Award winner and one of 16 men in history to pitch a perfect game. His pitching was so extraordinary that writer Roger Angel decided to write a book about him. But then Cone suffered the first serious slump of his career. We talk with Angel about his book, A Pitcher's Story. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. The Senate today approved a ban on new oil and gas drilling and coal mining in national monuments located in the West. NPR's David Wellner reports the vote comes as another setback for the Bush administration's energy plan.
The Democratic-controlled Senate voted 57-42 to outlaw any new energy extraction leases in national monuments. The vote follows a similar ban passed by the Republican-controlled House. The approval by both chambers now makes it likely the measure barring new leases in national monuments will be part of an eventual compromise interior appropriations bill that President Bush would have to decide whether or not to sign. The Bush administration has emphasized the need to evaluate the energy extraction possibilities of all federal lands as part of its plan to increase domestic oil production. Congress has also placed restrictions on government leases for offshore oil exploration against the administration's wishes. Nevertheless, the White House continues to push to open up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for oil and gas exploration. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
The White House said today President Bush's proposal for a pharmacy discount card for seniors is more than just a Band-Aid approach. Spokesman Ari Fleischer says the president still wants a prescription drug plan as part of an overall Medicare reform bill, but that may take some time, so Fleischer says Mr. Bush is proposing his discount card plan. The president plans to announce his Medicare reform package tomorrow. Under pressure from the courts, Microsoft is giving computer makers more flexibility in how they set up their operating systems and applications on new machines. From member station KPLU, Aaron Hennessy reports.
In a ruling last month, a federal appeals court found that Microsoft's agreements with manufacturers broke the law. The court said Microsoft used its power to illegally maintain a monopoly by giving preference to Microsoft products on the computer desktop. As a result, the software giant is changing its licensing agreements. Computer makers will be allowed to remove some shortcuts to Microsoft products from the Windows desktop, and computer makers can continue to add icons of other technology companies, such as Real Networks or AOL. Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer says a change will take place immediately. Ballmer also says settlement talks and further legal proceedings are possible in the continuing antitrust case. For NPR News, I'm Erin Hennessy in Seattle.
The Value Vision Home Shopping Network is paying the price for making some exaggerated health promises. The Federal Trade Commission says the network will offer refunds to customers who bought a variety of weight loss and health care products promoted with misleading claims. The move follows a settlement between the government and Value Vision International, which is partly owned by NBC and last month renamed its cable television network ShopNBC. On Wall Street, stock prices were mixed. The Dow was up 65 points to close at 10,241. The Nasdaq was up 9 points, closing the day at 1972. This is NPR News. Russian riot police have broken up a protest outside the International Olympic Committee meeting in Moscow. Iris Mackler reports from Moscow that the demonstrators were members of a Tibetan protest group objecting to China's bid to host the 2008 Games.
The Tibetan protest group opposes the candidacy of Beijing, widely regarded as the frontrunner to host the 2008 Games, on human rights grounds. Around 10 protesters carried a large banner with 5 bullet holes in place of the Olympic logo of 5 ringed circles. But when they unfurled it in front of the hotel where the IOC is meeting, Russian riot police swooped and tore the banner out of their hands. When the demonstrators tried to continue their protest, the police detained several of them. "This is the same thing that would happen in China," shouted one of the demonstrators. An IOC spokesman was asked about the incident, but said he couldn't comment until he was briefed. The Korean IOC member Kim Un-yong did know about the incident, but said he was prohibited from commenting because he's standing as a candidate to be president of the IOC in elections here next week. For NPR News, I'm Iris Mackler in Moscow.
An FBI official today predicted serious terrorist attacks on American interests abroad over the next 5 years, and Assistant Director Dale Watson says he believes an attack using a weapon of mass destruction is likely at home. Watson heads the Bureau's counterterrorism unit. He said the FBI tracks an average of 25 threats every day from terrorists against the U.S. targets at home and abroad. Forest officials suspect yesterday's deadly wildfire in Washington state was started by an unattended campfire that exploded out of control. The fire eventually overran firefighters, killing four of them. Fire crews have been withdrawn from the area until it's safe. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing Novasoy Brandeis O'Flavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
So tell me, Leonard, what is it you do in life?
Me?
You?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Yeah.
But what kind of nothing?
The nothing kind of nothing.
That's a scene from the new movie 101 Reykjavik, which was shot in Iceland by Icelandic actor and director Baltasar Kormákur. The film won the Discovery Award for the best first film at last year's Toronto Film Festival. It begins opening in American cities later this month. The music was co-composed by a founding member of the band The Sugar Cubes, which became Iceland's most famous cultural export. 101 Reykjavik is a comedy revolving around a 28-year-old slacker named Leinur, who still lives at home with his mother. He spends his days sleeping and watching TV, and his nights at the local bar. Things are pretty predictable until his mother decides she's a lesbian and invites her new lover Lola to move in. Then Lola ends up pregnant after a one-night stand with Leinur. This comedy is about coming of age very slowly, sexual confusion, and life in Iceland, a country that is cold, remote, and so small and insular that, as Kormákur says, you know almost everyone. Baltasar Kormákur has a very active life as a writer and director. I asked what attracted him to the story of a slacker.
Well, it's a bit of the opposite of myself. I've been doing too much in my short time. But actually, where this guy comes from is the same place as I do, and I wasn't interested in telling my own story coming of age, because nowadays people, or especially men, come much later of age than they used to. And I rather wanted to use somebody else's story to tell my own feelings and describe my environment.
What are some of the feelings you wanted to convey through telling this other person's story?
Well, like this sexual madness that is that in this part of the world, and a lot of partying and strange relationships, which I've been a part of as well.
Now, we might presume that the particular type of sexual madness in Iceland would have to do with the fact that it's so cold out so much of the time, and there's so little to do so much of the time that sex is a cheap and popular recreational activity.
Yeah, well, at the time when you're doing it, not later, if it has a child coming out of it.
Yes, right, which is part of the point of your movie. The main character in your movie, at the beginning of the movie, largely has a sexual relationship with himself, but later enters into one with his mother's lesbian lover, who he gets pregnant. He also gets pregnant his girlfriend. I'm wondering if there's a conservative or religious group that protests this type of plot in Iceland. Like in the United States, if a movie is mainstream enough and it will be noticed by very conservative groups or you know, conservative religious groups, there might be picket lines or protests. Anything like that in Iceland?
No, we don't really have that strong religious groups that would try to protest things like this. But when I because part of the film is shot in the Catholic Church in Iceland, and that's the only Catholic church in Iceland because it's a Lutheran country. And even, you know, the bishop accepted to give me a permission to shoot in there. So I think we are quite religiously open-minded, even the Catholics there.
Victoria Abril is one of the stars of your movie, and our listeners might know her from Pedro Almodovar's Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down. How did you end up casting her as the mother's lover?
For me, it was no other options, in a way, because I've been a fan of Victoria for quite some while, and you know, to cast somebody that you will believe a 30-year-old man falls in love with and a 50-year-old woman falls in love with, and all the audience has to fall in love with as well. There are not so many actresses who have this kind of sexual charisma without being, you know, with their body, more with their mind. And Victoria is one of these women that nobody can resist, and me neither. So I just went after her as much as I possibly could and insisted on having her, which was quite a job.
What did you say to her to convince her to leave Spain, to go to Iceland, to star in a movie by a film director who'd never made a movie before?
Yeah, that was exactly the problem.
right.
First of all, in the script, before I edited the film, she was coming in an airplane, and the stewardess said, it's 3 o'clock, it's minus 15 degrees, welcome to Iceland, have a pleasant stay. But she didn't read much more of the script. It was on the first page. So I had to get somebody to hunt her down and try to get her to read the script. And finally she did. And then I went to Paris to meet her, or actually her agent. And there's two airplanes to Paris from Iceland. And when I came, he said, oh, I forgot you were coming this week. Could you come next week? And then we just, went for her mobile phone number and called her up myself. And that worked.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Baltasar Kormákur, and he directed the new film 101 Reykjavik. It's a film set in Iceland where Kormákur lives. Part of the movie is set in a pub, and the main character describes the pub as his second home. So crowded and noisy, you hardly need to talk or dance. And you actually co-own the pub that you shot part of the movie in. Mm-hmm. Describe what a typical night at your pub is like.
Well, it's very much like in the film. It goes crazy in the weekends, and we used to have people dancing on tables there. It's a very nice cafe in the day, and then people start dancing on tables in the night, and even taking their tops off. Well, they don't do that much more, but you know, we used to do that. So it's very much like you see in the film, but it's a certain freedom that you neither have to dance or talk. You can just drink. That's the idea, and this is the way we publish our bars. You know. By saying nasty things about them.
was the pub the center of your nightlife when you were coming of age?
Yeah, it was, and that was the reason I decided to buy it, actually, because it seemed better investment than spending your money there.
Most of your new film, 101 Reykjavik, is shot indoors, but the outdoor scenes are really quite beautiful. Am I giving too much away if I say most of the outdoor scenes is the main character walking through the snow considering killing himself?
No, it's okay. The film starts with that anyway.
So there's long expanses of ice and snow overlooking the ocean. There's a beautiful sunset in the movie where the sun seems to be right on the floor of the earth because the horizon is so vast. What do you consider to be the grimmest and the most beautiful parts of life in Iceland?
Well, it is a big contrast, the whole country, you know. As much as it's beautiful outside, people mostly stay inside, except in the summer when there's light all day, you know, night and day. And then you have darkness the whole winter. So it's the whole contrast of the country that is quite rough. But you can see also in this shot, if you look closely, that you can see the moon and the sun in the same shot.
I guess I didn't look closely enough.
No, it's a bit difficult to see that. So that is something. And this, on this top of this glacier, actually, the book Journey into the Center of the Earth, that's exactly where they went down, into the center of the earth. And I can tell you a little nice story about this glacier. Is that for a few years ago, there were hundreds of people standing up there waiting for a spaceship to land there, because they really believed that there was a spaceship coming down. Of course, it never came, but they figured out it came in a format that they couldn't see it. Then a guy from a car sales lot called up and said they had changed the plan. They were going to land on his car sales lot, so people should go there.
Right.
So this was a big joke in the country.
What is it like to get through a winter where the sun never rises? I mean, how many days of darkness do you have to endure?
It's 9 months of darkness. Not the same darkness all the time, but like in December and January, you hardly see any light. Maybe 2 or up to 4 hours a day. But then the summer is so great that you forgive the country. But that's also why you can see in the film this kind of attitude towards the country when you say people only live there because they're born there, or this is a backwater in Siberia. This is how you feel in the winter. But it's different. You feel different towards your country in the summer.
Well, have you gone through periods of feeling that way, that the only reason people live in Iceland is because they're born there?
Yeah, I've been on my way to move to New York for the last 10 years. But, you know, it has a very strong grip on you, the country, at the same time.
I used to live in Buffalo, New York, which is upstate New York. In my memory, the trees didn't start to bud until late May. Now, maybe that's just my memory, but that's how I recall it. And much as I really loved living there when I did, there was a period in late March when people would just be so depressed because the winter was so long and there was no real promise that it was going to end immediately. Do you find that toward the end of winter in Iceland that people are just incredibly depressed and nearly on the verge of suicide?
There is a very high suicidal rate in Iceland, one of the highest in the world. And I'm sure that's a part of it, you know. But usually it happens in the spring when the summer starts coming and people, you know, they're waiting for the summer all this time and then they see that nothing is really going to change. So it's a big problem in Iceland.
I'm wondering if you're prone to depression right at that cusp of winter and spring when it looks like spring really is never going to come.
Well, I do a lot of horseback riding. That is my favorite thing. At this time, the horsemanship really is starting. So it saves me from my desperation. It's just to go riding out into the country. And actually, when I go back home now, I'm going to ride for 2 weeks in the wilderness. So that's what I do every summer.
My guest is Icelandic director and actor Baltasar Kormákur. He directed the new movie 101 Reykjavik. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Baltasar Kormákur, and he's the director of the new film 101 Reykjavik. It's a film set in Iceland, which is the country that he's from. This is his first film. He's also performed and directed theater in Iceland. Now, your mother's from Iceland. Your father moved to Iceland from Spain. Why did he leave Spain, and why was his destination Iceland?
This is a very romantic story, if you're ready to listen to it. My father left Spain because of Franco. He's a Catalan and wasn't even allowed to speak his own language. So as he finished Bellas Artes, which is a university of fine arts in Barcelona, he went to Iceland to earn some money in a herring ship to be able to buy canvas and paint. And on the way out, because he was not going to spend his life in this weird little country, he met my mother in a cafe who just came out from the countryside to study. And I think they were engaged in 18 days, and he's still there after 40 years.
Now, did you get a different view of Iceland from your father, who wasn't a native, and the cold and the dark were new to him? Did he complain about it a lot?
Well, he doesn't complain. He loves the country very much, and he paints a lot of the old mythology from the sagas and this stuff, and he's very fascinated by the country. But of course, he has a bit different view on the country than maybe most Icelanders, and like every small country, it has it's less now, but it has a lot of racism and you know, small town elements, which it makes him a little bit hard for him.
Was the racism directed at him?
Yeah, when he came to Iceland first, it was very much directed against him.
I guess Iceland must be a fairly homogenous country.
It's been changing the last years. Because there's a lot of, in the fish industry, there's a lot of Polish people and Asian people working there now because the Icelandic youth is not interested in the fishing industry at all. So they have to import people to work there. So it has changed a lot. But of course, it's nothing like in the States.
Now, did you shoot your movie in the winter or the summer?
I did actually both. I shot the half part of it in January, and that was night exterior because then you have night all day as well. And then the other scenes I shot when I need day, I shot that in the summertime. And also because to get Victoria to come to Iceland, because she wasn't really fond of spending the winter there.
So were you ever in the position of having to use fake snow because you were shooting in the summertime? Even though you were in Iceland, you had to use fake snow?
Yeah, and there's another thing. You can't really control the snow, you know. So if it would snow for... you're shooting one scene for 10 hours, and if you have to have snow all the time, you know, you wouldn't... the whole set would disappear. So we had to use in combination. Sometimes in the same shot, you can see real snow and fake snow. But as people who lived with snow for a long time, we have very good technicians in making fake snow because they know all the differences of snow and we're very much into it. And I'm sure I've asked people, nobody can really see the difference of fake and real snow on the film.
You've had an active career in Iceland directing and performing. Among the plays you've directed are Hamlet, Hair, the Rocky Horror Picture Show, and among the plays you've performed in are West Side Story. What else?
Romeo and Romeo and Julia, Constantine the sequel. It's too many. I can't really remember them. And then I've done a few films. And the last film actually I shot in New York with Hal Hartley. So,
the shows that you've done are in Icelandic. I'm wondering how Shakespeare sounds in Icelandic, or how the lyrics to West Side Story are sung in Icelandic. Would it be asking too much to ask you to sing a few bars from a West Side Story song in
Icelandic?
Yes,
that would be too much.
That would be too much.
Because I played that part who mostly dances. I can dance for you in the studio if you want, but singing. I did the Puerto Ricano part, and he doesn't sing at all.
So, okay.
Sounds much better than people might imagine. For example, I can you know the lines of to be or not to be would be like this: að vera eða vera ekki, þar liggur efinn. This is the most famous Shakespearean line.
Is there much work for actors in Iceland?
Yeah, by now there is. When I was graduating, there were only like two big theaters, the National and the City Theater. But we found it after the Hair. I found it a theater was called the Castle in the Sky, and from that point there was a lot of independent theaters and coming up, and now there is even lack of actors sometimes when you're casting, and also the film industry has bloomed and there are more television stations producing stuff. So it's quite good right now.
Some of the traditional literature of Iceland is in saga form, epic stories. Has that affected your storytelling sensibility, do you think?
Yeah, I think definitely. We learn it in the school, and it's the humor and the bleakness of these stories are incredible, you know. And of course, that affects the way to tell a story and the humor. And I'm very interested in doing one of the sagas, which is called Burning Neil. It's one of the most famous.
Is it Burning Needle?
Burning Neil. Neil is a name.
Oh.
It's Brennu Njál saga in Icelandic. I don't know. I think it will be translated something like that.
What's it about?
It's actually about two women from the Viking time that have a huge quarrel, and their men who are friends end up killing each other. And I love it. You never see stories about women from that time, and they are the real characters in the story. And it's called Hallgerður Langbrók og Bergþóra. These are real big women, and they're very, very dear to Icelandic women. And the one Hallgerður, she kills in a way her husband, because earlier in the story he slaps her, and when he has been his enemies are attacking him and his string of his bow breaks, he asks for a hair out of her of her head to be able to keep on fighting, and she says, "I will pay you now for the slap." And in these words, he dies. So they're big women.
Well, I thank you so much. I wish you good luck with the new movie. Thank you.
Thank you, too.
Baltasar Kormákur is the director of the new film 101 Reykjavik. It begins opening in American cities later this month. Here's another scene from the film. Hlynur, the slacker, is at a bar sitting in between his girlfriend and his mother's lover. This is Fresh Air.
So, what's your New Year's resolution then, Linus?
Well, you know, same as usual, be out of bed by noon.
Maybe out of the house. Imagine, I spotted Hildur venturing into the garden today.
Wow!
Wait, he even brought the garbage with him.
That must be your good influence.
Maybe, who knows? And maybe one day he will venture out into the big wide world and find a place of his own.
So, is that the plan then, Linus?
No.
Do you know any single mother out there who needs someone to look after?
No.
No?
But I might know of a single girlfriend.
Oh, no. He doesn't seem to be into that for some reason.
Oh, you never know with that guy.
I see what you mean. I'm still trying to figure him out myself.
Yeah, you know all about the great divide between the sexes, don't you?
You say that because I'm a lesbian.
A real lesbian?
Yes. Oh, please.
Father of yes.
Calla ya.
Tell me, what's it like? I've always been curious about that, you know, to know what it's like.
There is only one way to find out, my sweetheart.
Can I come too?
No, I don't take groups.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The Rose Grower by Michel de Kretzer, a novel about France during the Reign of Terror and the cultivation of roses. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, when a celebrated baseball pitcher can't throw. We talk with writer Roger Angel about pitcher David Cohn. Last year, Cohn had a disastrous season. Angel chronicled it in his new book, A Pitcher's Story. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. David Cohn is a great pitcher who won a Cy Young Award as best pitcher in his league. He's one of 16 men in history to pitch a perfect game. Last year, New Yorker writer Roger Angel chronicled Cohn's season with the Yankees for a book about Cohn. Angel expected this book to be about an aging pitcher still displaying his mastery. But it turned out to be a disastrous season for Cohn and his last season with the Yankees. Cohn is now with the Boston Red Sox. Angel's new book about Cohn, A Pitcher's Story, has just been published. He's the author of several other books about baseball, and he's an editor and writer at The New Yorker. Last year, when it became clear that Cohn's slump was going to be a long one, Angel told him that it might make for a more interesting book than one about triumph. I asked Angel if it risked being embarrassing for Cohn to have such a bad season be the focus of a book.
It was acutely embarrassing and painful for him. He was not used to this. He had a losing season since his very first beginning season with the Mets when he was, I think, 5-6. But he'd been a triumphant pitcher, and he didn't know what was happening to him. He was always, at the same time, there was the hovering over him was the notion that he'd suddenly gotten too old, 38, and this is old for a pitcher. And he refused to say, I'm too old. He would not accept that. But something had clearly gone wrong. And I began to feel like a paparazzo. I began to feel like somebody was hanging around bad news. Or this sort of become a little scandal that I was still there. And I was a burden for him, I think. But to his immense credit, and I expected no less from him, but he was just astounding. He stayed with me the whole way. We had no contract. He could have walked away at any point and said, I don't want to do this. It isn't going the way I wanted it to. But he didn't. He was the other way. He kept saying, I'm letting you down. I'm sorry I'm letting you down. And then he would apologize, which was, again, even more painful.
I'm wondering if he was ever superstitious that it was the book and your attention that was partly causing his bad luck.
I don't think it ever came up. Dave is too smart for that. He's extremely intelligent, and he's not particularly superstitious. I never found any superstitions through the year that wearing certain clothing or taking a certain route out to the mound or changing his diet or whatever. He didn't have any of those. But he just went back out there and kept experimenting. He was always a free-form pitcher. The great thing about David was that he himself didn't know what he was going to throw on a given day until the moment the first batter appeared. And his catchers told me later on, Joe Girardi in particular, that with David you didn't really have a game plan because he would go to what was working for him on that given day. And sometimes in the first or second inning he would discover what was working and you'd go from there. But this is a great asset for a pitcher, but it became a terrific problem for him this last year because he experimented too much. He changed form almost from game to game.
I'm wondering what it was like for you to watch David Cohn fail at the mound. And before you talk about that, I want to quote a couple of kind of conflicting things that you say in the book. You write, "This wasn't the Cohn I'd watched and written about, and I hadn't understood how quickly a sense of betrayal envelops us fans when our old heroes go south. This isn't what we want from you, this bumbling and struggling. Show us how to win again. Go out there and be great." You say, "I hated what was happening. Seeing performers struggle through an injury is commonplace in the sport, but being forced to watch a damaged player endure repeated humiliation is barbarous." But you also say, "The more I saw Cohn in confusion and pain, the better I liked him. Was it because I could see something fallible in him now that he couldn't control the games and batters and turn them to his bidding? Or was it because he'd become more like me?" Talk about those conflicting emotions of feeling somehow that he let you down, but also feeling like you identified with him more.
I never felt that he let me down, but I did realize that something different was happening that we hadn't expected. And I did like him better. I sensed I was less in awe of him. He was more fallible, more human. This brings up a very interesting point, which I've noticed before in baseball. When a great performer falters and isn't himself, after a couple of times, fans or semi-fans bring this up, and they speak of him in an entirely different tone. This happened with Tones. This happened with David Cohen last summer, friends of mine, and say, well, he isn't what he used to be, is he? He's no good out there. He's terrible. What's happened to him? And they said this with a sort of an enjoyment, a pleasure. I use the word schadenfreude in there, that they were taking pleasure out of his pain. But it's more than that. He had become human, and these great athletes are superhuman in the most literal sense. They're beyond us. What they do is beyond our capabilities. And while we admire it, we're in awe of it, when they stumble and fail, as they inevitably will, as they stay on in the games, we're relieved that we're not threatened by them in some way. Very strange, very interesting, and an integral part of sports, I think.
But you also talk about this, how you felt that watching him perform in that damaged state with his injuries was a humiliation. It was barbarous.
Well, that was later. This was, David had a severe injury in early September. He fell fielding a bunt in Kansas City. I was out there. Sitting with his parents, actually. That's his hometown. And he was pitching better by then. He'd turned the corner, it seemed, and things were going his way. And he ran after, in the fourth inning, ran against the Royals. He ran after a little infield pop and dived for the ball and landed on his left shoulder and dislocated the left shoulder, not his pitching arm. Left arm dislocated, driven up into his neck. Horrible injury. And they pulled it out. Popped back into place eventually after about a half an hour in the training room. But he couldn't pitch after that until the postseason. He only missed one turn as a pitcher, insisted he wanted to go back out there, and Joe Torre, out of respect, let him do it. But his motion was damaged by the injury, and the batters just feasted on him after that. And that's when I felt it was obscene watching him, that he was defenseless and not himself at all.
Well, he's playing with Boston now. Well, how's the season been for him so far?
It's much better. The whole thing has worked out. It's terrific. It's a great story, and people are beginning to notice that he took a great chance to come back with the Red Sox. He's almost the worst of some offers he got that wasn't guaranteed, but he was excited by the prospect. He was turned down by the prospect of pitching in Fenway Park. Pitching before them for those rabid fans, and he who'd been a hated Yankee pitcher, that rivalry is still very intense, would be pitching for the other side now and pitch against the Yankees in Fenway Park. He loved that idea. Anything to get that edge, as he said, the thing that would say, in this game, I got this going for me. Now I'm a Red Sox pitcher pitching against the Yankees. The pitching coach, the Red Sox pitching coach, Joe Kerrigan, came to him in the offseason along with the manager, Jimmy Williams. And Kerrigan had been charting his pitches, although he was not, he was with a different club, and said he thought he'd seen some things he was doing wrong. And they in January, before he signed with the Red Sox, they went over this in detail, what David might have been doing wrong last year.
What is he doing differently now?
Well, his basic motion, what he'd settled for in the end last year, he would stand on the mound on the rubber with both feet on the rubber, as all pitchers do, and then he would take a considerable backward step with his right foot and sort of toward first base. So he would swing toward first base and then with his hands extended away from his body more than most pitchers have, he would then swing a little bit toward third base to make up for the back step and then go into his deliver the pitch and then come straight down toward the batter. So he was making this circuitous journey before he actually threw the ball. Kerrigan, Joe Kerrigan, his pitching coach, has straightened him out and simplified what he's doing. His backward step is just a little backward lean, a tiny sort of a half step, and then he comes straight forward, and his hands are close to his body all the time, and it's made him much more economical and more effective. And even his fastball, which is not what it used to be, but his fastball has been up in the mid-90s from time to time. He's throwing more curveballs than sliders. The sliders, you have to throw at the very outermost end of your delivery with your arm extended and your fingers sort of tugging down on the ball, an extreme effort pitch. He's varying that with more curveballs, which are easier on the arm. And he's given up too many home runs, but his pattern right now is he tends to give up a home run fairly early and then to be absolutely untouchable for the next four or five innings. But he's having success, which is great.
My guest is Roger Angel, an editor and writer for The New Yorker. His new book is called A Pitcher's Story, Innings with David Cohn. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Roger Angel, whose new book is called A Pitcher's Story, Innings with David Cohn. Now, David Cohn is considered a pretty old pitcher because he's 39 now. You know, a sports career is a fairly short career. You're 80, and you're still writing. So, you know, a writer's career doesn't, a writer's career keeps going.
Well, let's wait and see, Terry. But I said before I wrote a word about this, early on when we agreed to do the book, it was in January last year, I came to David one day and I said, look, David, here's the deal. I just figured it out. My brain and your arm are about the same age. Let's see what happens. He sort of laughed.
Did you identify with him at all, with people thinking that he was getting old and you pushing 80 and still writing?
Well, the question is, did he identify with me? I hope not. Because I am a lot older than he is, but he understood. It was amazing to him to hear that it's hard to write a book. He is extremely curious and a very smart, quick guy. And he said, "I didn't know this was going to be hard for you." And I said, "Writing is hard." And he said, "I didn't know that." So it was a combined thing, and that's what makes this book interesting. It seems to me. I think there's a lot of emotion in this book, and there's the emotion of someone fighting the courage and class that David showed all last year to get a few moments of redemption at the end, which he does. And there is the struggle of, how is this book going to come out? Because I say this all the way through, what was going to happen? And it does come out at the end. And in the end, he did an amazing thing. I mean, he really astounded me. After the season was over, he appeared against one batter in the World Series, Mike Piazza. He was brought into a game by Joe Torre, got a big out. I got rid of Piazza, who had already hit a home run in that game and almost hit another one. It was the main threat for the Mets, of course, and got him out, and that was the end of his career with the Yankees. It was the last out.
When David Cohn was going through that really bad season last year, what did he make of it? How much of it did he think was physical, you know, a result of injury and just like long-term arm or shoulder problems, and how much of it did he think was psychological?
He didn't think it was physical. The strange thing about David's year last year was that he had no pain at all. For the first time in his entire career, he had no pain at all. In fact, at one point he said, maybe I should feel pain in order to feel better. Maybe that's what's wrong. Maybe that's what's missing. It was a complete mystery. I don't think he felt that his arm was damaged in any way. So that added to the mystery.
Was last year the first time Cohn had a really bad slump?
Yes, it was. Absolutely. He had been a winning pitcher all through the 80s and the 90s, and had also been, in spite of pain and injury, he'd gone a stretch of something like 9 years, never missed a start, which is almost unheard of. He had the second longest run in Major League history of never giving up two losses in a row. He went 97 starts in a row without giving up two losses, one after the other. That's the second highest mark in baseball history. He led the league in strikeouts two or three times and tied a couple of other times. So a pitcher who expected a lot and got a lot and never really experienced anything like what happened last year.
So what did he make of it? What did he think caused it?
Well, the question, of course, the hovering question, which is what I want to get to, was in the back of his mind. Maybe I'm getting old. Maybe I'm too old. He said that occasionally. Athletes are not going to be able to go on forever. We watch them because at their best, we belong to the same species. And at their very best, the great ones do things that we can't imagine we can do, but we can because through them we do it. But then they slow down and get old. And they face what we all face, which is a diminished performance. We are not what we were. And with them, when it stops, they die. They die as athletes. They cease to exist. I remember when Joe DiMaggio came up, and I was about 14 years old, and I saw him as a 15 years old. I saw him as a, actually, he was 17 when he came into the majors. But I watched Joe from the moment he arrived in baseball till the time he retired in 1951. And in that period, you see somebody grow to their full flower, begin to look middle-aged, begin to strain, begin to have injuries, fade, and die and leave the scene. And David is going through this year. He might be approaching his own death. I never say that in the book. I wouldn't go that far. But that notion is hanging over this whole book. This is late in the pitcher's career. He is not himself. All of us experience this. This is what, maybe to go back to that other point, why we feel closer to athletes when they begin to slow down, when they are more like us, because they are fading and failing the way we all are.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Roger Angel. We're talking about his new book, A Pitcher's Story, Innings with David Cohn. It's about the pitcher David Cohn. Roger Angel, let's talk about your writing career a bit. You've been writing for The New Yorker since 1946, so that's 45 years. When you started writing for The New Yorker, your mother was the fiction editor. Your stepfather, E.B. White, was one of the magazine's star writers. Did it feel like the family business to you?
Yeah, it did. I mean, I didn't think in those terms then, but I really wanted to be a writer, I guess, and an editor, too, so I ended up doing both. And writing for The New Yorker seemed the natural thing. And I did write a couple of little fiction pieces. When back those days, we could have tiny little back-of-the-book fiction pieces that got me going. But I think I'd learned from my stepfather really how hard writing is. I mean, his writing always, E.B. White's writing always looks absolutely like the easiest thing in the world. Just nothing to it. There's no strain in anything he ever wrote. But I'd watched him as a teenager when he was writing the notes and comment page for The New Yorker every week, and he'd go into his study up in Maine and close the door and be there all day long, and there were long silences between little rips and sounds from the typewriter. And he'd come out, and he'd be silent and pale, not saying anything at lunch, and at the end of the day, he'd file it off, and then the next day, he'd say it wasn't good enough. He'd try to get it back again. Writing is hard, and I think that there aren't many writers who write with ease. So I got that idea early on, too.
Your mother was fiction editor of The New Yorker, and this was in an era where not that many women even worked. And certainly most of the women who did work worked in traditional women's professions. And being fiction editor of The New Yorker doesn't fall in that category. Were you aware of how unusual it was to have your mother do what she was doing?
Terry, I don't think I was sufficiently aware. I mean, I always admired her, and she thought of herself. She didn't use the word feminist, but she spoke of herself as being a working woman. But work was so much a part of her life, and The New Yorker was the main event in her life, really, and it surrounded her every day. And I think of her now, and I think of her with galleys in a manila envelope under her arm or around the house or even in bed in the mornings or something, a bunch of galleys and soft brown pencils and softer and erasers, a lot of erasing, the stuff that comes off erasers around her and smoking cigarettes. And that was the standard of her life. And she was deeply involved with the magazine and with her writers. I think that if Andy White inspired me to be a writer, then certainly she inspired me to be an editor. I actually ended up as the fiction editor of The New Yorker myself. I'm still a fiction editor there. And at one point, I inherited her old office. And a shrink that I was seeing at the time heard that I'd moved into her old office and on the same job that she'd had. And he said, "This is the greatest single act of sublimation in my experience."
Now, when you were growing up, did your friends have mothers who worked?
No, not many of them, I guess. Some of them, sure. I went to the old Progressive Lincoln School here in New York, so there were some working mothers, but it was the exception.
What set this apart as a progressive school? What made it different from the other schools?
Well, it was the original John Dewey Progressive School, and as kids, we didn't learn grammar, but we did a lot of writing. And that's one thing I remember. I never learned the rules of grammar.
Do you miss that as an editor?
I know good grammar. I picked it up somewhere along the line. Later, I went to a somewhat more formal boarding school and picked up a few things along the way. But we wrote symphonies and made our own instruments and performed them on these weird instruments and stuff like that. It was faintly cuckoo, but it was a lot of fun. And it made you think that maybe you can do it, whatever it is you want to do.
My guest is Roger Angel. He's an editor and writer for The New Yorker. His new book is called A Pitcher's Story, Innings with David Cohn. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Roger Angel. He's the author of the new book, A Pitcher's Story, Innings with David Cohn. Angel is also a writer and editor for The New Yorker. Your stepfather, E.B. White, was the co-writer of, you know, the most used style book, Strunk and White. Is that a style book you've used over the years?
Oh, sure, yeah. There is a set of general advice in there. Be clear, don't be fancy. I don't have them by heart, but that's the heart of the book. There are lots of helpful hints about punctuation, and Andy White once told me the rule about that and which I memorized on the spot. He said, "The New Yorker is the magazine that cares about which. The New Yorker is a magazine that cares about that." No, I'm sorry. The A magazine which cares about that.
Oh, see, this never helps me. I'm still as confused as ever.
One is the defining, the magazine that, or non-defining, a magazine, comma, which.
You know, with that in which, I always say to myself, should I struggle again to figure out what the difference is between the two, or should I give up and figure most people don't really care anyways? What advice would you have for me on that?
I think you're right. That's,
give up?
I don't stop and think about it. I just put down what I mean. Part of my mind does this anyway. Usually gets it right, and I don't stop and say, is this the correct form? And I will. The big thing is to look at what you've written and to when it's done and to see if it's any good and to also to think about how it sounds. I think a lot about how writing sounds. You can have a perfect sentence that sounds terrible in the end. If you almost say it to yourself as you're closing it at the end, you'll probably get it right. I still edit John Updike, and this is what he does. He corrects over and over, and he corrects on page proofs. The last day things are going in, he will rewrite and rewrite, and he'll say on the phone to me, "How's that sound? How's that sound to you, Roger?" And I do the same thing to myself. How's that sound? It's writing is meant to be heard as well as looked at.
You've been writing for The New Yorker since 1956, and your mother before that was a fiction editor, and your stepfather E.B. White was a writer. So you've been affiliated with the magazine for as long as anyone, probably. The magazine has changed a lot over the years, particularly since William Shawn left. And some people are very nostalgic for The New Yorker's past. Are you?
No, not really. I think weathering the change after Sean was a shock for everybody. he'd been there for so long, and he was such an amazingly powerful and compelling figure, and also a very human one with some immense drawbacks, I think. New Yorker people tended to be New Yorker people and nothing else. New Yorker writers felt there was no, many of them felt they could only write at a fair place like that. It was ideal that you could, they couldn't dream of writing anywhere else, and that, that this all was personified in Sean, that Sean made it right, and without him, the magazine would not be what it was. And he himself felt this way. I think he felt that, and I've heard him say that, it said if, more than once, if I go, the magazine will die. I think he half wanted that. Some part of him wanted that after he'd gone that the magazine would not be there anymore because he so identified with it. And there was a tendency to identify the New Yorker on the staff of some people with life itself or with Western civilization or whatever. There was sort of a large shimmering ideal there. And when that ended, some people were angry, some people left, some people just couldn't go on. Some people took it out on Tina Brown, who was Bob Gottlieb, the next editor. But when Tina arrived, they took it out on her. They took it out on Cy at Newhouse. Nothing lasts forever. The magazine goes on. It's a really good magazine. It's an excellent magazine. It's not the New York that it was. Nothing is the same as it was. I'm happy to be there. I've been able to change, and I write shorter than I used to. I don't feel constrained by what it's like now. I think Remnick is an excellent editor. I love working for him. I enjoyed working for Tina. She was very seductive to work for. She made you want to write for her. Her magazine was very little like Sean's. It was a big shock. And some people couldn't take it. And for others, you just go on. And I'm extremely glad I was able to do it. I've been able to do it.
Roger Angel, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Great pleasure. Thank you, Terry.
Roger Angel is a writer and editor for The New Yorker. His new book is called A Pitcher's Story, Innings with David Cohn. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Audi, presenting Audi-assured certified pre-owned cars, including the A4, A6, and A8, with quattro all-wheel drive. AudiUSA.com/pre-owned. And Vintage Books, a division of Random House and publishers of the new paperback novel White Teeth by Zadie Smith. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we discuss Slobodan Milosevic's upcoming trial before the International War Crimes Tribunal with New York Times reporter Steve Erlanger. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.